Welcome to Water for Fighting, where we discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers. This week's discussion is brought to you by Sea and Shoreline and Resource Environmental Solutions. Sea and Shoreline is the Southeast's leading innovator in protecting coastal communities from devastating storms and restoring ecosystems that once faced ecological collapse. Visit their website at www.seaandshoreline.com. And of course, RES. RES is the nation's leader in ecological restoration, helping to restore Florida's natural resources with water quality and stormwater solutions that offer communities guaranteed performance and outcomes. Check them out at www.res.us. Now, if you enjoyed these discussions here on Water for Fighting, I think you're also going to want to check out the Florida Specifier and the Florida Specifier podcast. The Specifier has become Florida's environmental news source of record, and the podcast has become the go-to place for staying up to speed on current environmental news and newsmakers here in the Sunshine State. You can join the discussion as we explore the latest environmental news and developments that matter to you. So go to www.floridaspecifier.com to check it out. Today, I'm very happy to introduce a friend of mine and former colleague, Eric Sutton. Eric has worked for Sarasota County, the Southwest Florida Water Management District, where I met him, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, where he would eventually serve as its executive director, and is now the vice president at Garcia Land Management and Environmental Services. Eric, thanks for being here, man.
Oh, pleasure to be here, Brett. Thank you.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm doing really well.
Awesome. Before we get into the crux of, you know, baby Eric Sutton and his grandparents and all that kind of good stuff, I want to pause for just a second. You spent, I think, the first part of your career, probably a solid 8-10 years, maybe probably more, down in Sarasota and West Central Florida.
Correct.
Given that we're on the back end of Hurricane Milton, which has just happened, you've got to still have folks down there that you talk to. How's it looking down there from what you've heard?
From what I've heard, there's pockets that are really a problem, and other areas more inland that it's just been a little bit more of a nuisance, and really just depends. My parents evacuated up to Tallahassee. They still live in Sarasota. They were able to go back pretty quickly. They didn't even lose power for a significant time, versus my friend that lives north of Dade City. He just got power like 8 days after the storm passed. And I don't know if you've experienced this. When these hurricanes happen, you see all of the devastation for about 24-hour period. And then the news cycle moves on to other things. And then when I traveled down south on the East Coast last week, I was reminded it's still a mess over there where those tornadoes hit, particularly in the Wellington area. So the friends, I kept a close tabs on them, but they're all recovering. It's a slow process, depending on how much damage you got, of course.
That's the key, really, isn't it? And Florida gets hit by, you know, a goodly number of hurricanes, but it does happen like that. I think probably even Andrew, to some extent, was like that. So you have Andrew, big one, Michael, a big one.
Irma.
Yeah, and the devastation is massive, and the recovery is a long slog. And if you go there, you can see it. The problem is people don't go there, and like you said, they pack up the cameras and disappear. And then that's it. You're left to deal with the recovery stuff and everyone else moves on. So it's gotta be a kind of an isolating feeling. So hopefully the, you know, folks will be paying attention, you know, up here in the next 6 to 12 months is gonna be really important.
Yes, exactly. And you know, you mentioned Michael. That was one when I was in my position as executive director, went down the sunrise the morning after that. And that's a sight I'll never forget.
Yeah.
It was devastating. Just Mexico Beach, just no houses existed. It was definitely a learning experience. And that wasn't my first one, but that one was just like a tight bush hog. And, you know, we felt quite a few effects in Tallahassee.
Yeah. I mean, it's wild. And Tallahassee continues to get very lucky, relatively speaking, that's for sure. But even with Michael, we have a little bit of a property at my house and lots of trees, which are great. But a lot of those trees ended up across the power line. And it takes, you know, it took a while just to get to there. And that's at really Cat 1 wins in Tallahassee. And so to think of some of these places, especially when you go across Highway 20, you know, come down 71, 69, it's almost unbelievable to see in person.
It is. But thanks for asking, you know, everyone's doing well.
Good, good. All right, so now let's get to the beginning. And I get to say something about you and your family that I don't believe I have gotten to say at all yet, which is your parents were born in the same place as you, and you grew up in that place all together, one spot. And it didn't matter if it was Florida or another state. I don't think I've ever heard that before. And so you are special in that regard. So let's talk about your parents and grandparents. And we're talking about Henderson, Kentucky, right? And I want to get to them first, but then I want to talk about Henderson itself, which is a really cool place. I'm doing like my research on you and that area. So it's really cool. But let's start with your family first. And let's do this with your mother's side of the family first, if you don't mind. And then we'll move to talk about your dad's side.
Okay. Well, for starters, just in case they listen, they were wonderful parents. No, they've been great support over all the years. And mom's side, my grandpa was a steel worker. Worked in the oil fields kind of all around, and then they settled in that area. I don't really know a lot about his history, but yes, in Henderson, Kentucky, is where they were reared.
I went to basic training in Kentucky at Fort Knox.
Okay.
But beyond that, I know almost nothing other than it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my life. Which part of the state? So you have different parts of the state. Are horses everywhere? Is it coal? I mean, which is it over toward the Indiana, Ohio side where you see more of the steel work and coal work? How does that work in Kentucky geographically?
I think there's really two sides of Kentucky with a transition in the middle. On the eastern side, it's very much like what you see in Appalachia, mm-hmm. sort of, you know, stereotypes, not as touristy, very rugged country, people in their multiple generations, coal is king. Then on the western side, which where Henderson is, more farms. And in the central part, that's really where a lot of the horse farms are. That's pretty good description in general of Kentucky.
All right. So I digress there, but let's get back to your grandfather again. I know you didn't know, you said a whole lot about his history, but at least from what you recall.
Papa, as we called him, he lived a ripe old age, started a company just across the river in Evansville, Indiana, and it was steelworking. We remanufactured cylinders, and my dad would later open a business and remanufacture hydraulic pumps. Hmm. And at the time, we served a lot of the mining industry. And then over time, we diversified because the mining industry had a lot of peaks and valleys, and the valleys were getting deeper and deeper. But that's where I first worked when I was 13, worked for my grandpa. Oh. He was an avid fisherman, avid hunter. Of course, in that part of Kentucky, you'd better be one of those because there's not a whole heck of a lot else to do unless you like getting in trouble, which that I did as well.
Right. We'll get to that too.
So he was a very strong entrepreneur. My grandma, terrific grandmother. And what's even odd, I tell a lot of people this, I knew my great grandparents very well, but my two great grandmas passed away when I was 16.
Wow.
So we got to know them really well. Think about them daily. They have great influence. And it's just really interesting how we had all of that family in that region. And fast forward to today, and we're just, you know, the survivors and the offspring are really not in touch, and we're spread out everywhere, which probably is indicative of a lot of families.
Yeah,
coming from the baby boomers.
Are there economics involved there as well? I mean, when you go back to, like you said, both your great grandmas being there, having a chance to be with them, perhaps it was easier. Were they part of farming families? You know, where it was just easier to be in the same place for your entire life. I mean, it's not a big place that you're from.
No. There's like population 36,000. I don't think that's changed in 50 years.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's pretty indicative of those farm-based families. And then as the farming industry changes, so does the demographics. And I think that's probably a reason.
Well, let's talk about your mom then, her relation to those great-grandmas, that side of the family. Were both your parents from Henderson?
My mom was actually, according to her, was born in Maryland, but it was as part of my grandpa going around and working in oil fields. But they all had their roots there. My great-granny Townsend was my grandpa's mom. And so, yeah, the farms were there in Kentucky, but my grandpa went on to work. So she technically wasn't born there, but for all intents and purposes, she's from there.
Yeah. I hear you. I say this, my older brother was born in Virginia Beach, but it was a Navy thing, and so he has no recollection whatsoever. Right. Like, we're Florida people. Let's move on to your dad. Tell me about his side of the family.
So my dad's side of the family, we weren't quite as close with all of them. My grandpa, Sutton, he passed away when I was pretty young, like six or seven. I do have some memories. And then my grandma, she lived on but had failing health, and so she was in a nursing home, so really didn't have a lot of connection there. A very different background, but from carpentry. Now my dad's twin brother, he and my grandpa Sutton and my dad, they did carpentry for many years. So when I was as young as I can remember, I was always, at least I think I was helping them on construction sites. I know I was when I was carrying roofing up the ladder.
Right.
That, yeah, I got those jobs, but I learned a lot about, you know, how to fix and to do certain things. Yeah, it was a big carpentry family.
Yeah, let's just jump right to it then in that sense, because there's so many ties to family, so many ties to what that means to you. And that's kind of one of those running themes of this show anyway, which is to kind of get back to what people's, you know, histories and motivations are and how they got to be who they are now. And so talk about you. You were born in Henderson, right?
Correct.
And so let's talk about you as a young child, given that kind of that level setting of grandfather loved to hunt and fish, carpenters, both sides in terms of what they did for a living. How much of that affected your everyday life? And I'm talking very young, like before junior high school.
Well, I think that it was work hard, play hard, always outside, always, not inside much at all. There was always a requirement to help. That, you know, so I think about my girls. I don't think they understand, but it was a lot of work, a lot of chores, a lot of expectations put on me. And of course, I pushed back as any child would do. But I think that really had a important role in understanding a good work ethic.
Tell me about then. Tell me about the chores. Tell me about the household. What that looked like.
I'm sure there's a little hyperbole here, but I'll give you an example. We had 8.5 acres where I grew up, and a lot of it needed to be mowed weekly. And my expectation was that I had to mow it. And it wasn't like the zero turns of today. In fact, it was one of those old snappers. You remember, like, with the pretzel-like handle?
Yes.
And that it literally took more acreage than it does for a semi to do a turn. So you would, like, it would take a good 2 days to mow this, if you could get it started. And then we had my dad a bunch of trees planted, and I would get $15. But if I nicked a tree, it cost me $5. So he would tell you the story differently. But I always say it ended up costing me money mowing that yard. But it was, yeah, we had hunting dogs that I took care of for my grandpa. We had horses. So yeah, it was a lot of chores living on that sort of land. And we had a really cool couple of acres of forest behind where I had all my forts and things like that and played a lot. And
did you spend time? Did your grandparents live at different places where you might go there and spend time as well? I know I did different towns that my grandparents lived in, but that would happen a lot. Did that happen with you in that sense?
Well, being the big metropolis of Henderson, my grandparents lived on the outskirts in a little town called Basket. Actually, I lived in Zion. Okay. And so, but it's all Henderson. It was relatively, I mean, it's spread out, it's rural,
right.
But yeah, pretty much it's all Henderson.
The greater metropolitan Henderson area.
Yeah. It's a cute little town.
Let's get off track to what I said we were going to do. And let's talk about Henderson then, you know, a little bit, and then we'll go back to your life there. Henderson's on the Ohio River, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And the other side of that river is Indiana. In fact, it's Evansville, right?
Correct.
Also not that far from, I guess you got to go up the river to hit Ohio itself. How close to the river did you live?
I lived pretty close, actually, by way the crow flies, to the Green River, which connects to the Ohio right there and close to downtown Henderson. And so we spent a lot of time on that river, but yeah, not too far. And of course, downtown's right on the Ohio, and that was kind of the hangout in high school, was the riverfront.
That sounds about right. And the, you know, and speaking of the Green River, I couldn't help it. It's like I'm looking through, and I'm like, it's Kentucky, and whiskey features, won't call it prominently, but it features in this podcast. And so I'm looking and, you know, to see what distillery might be near where you grew up. And there, in fact, the Green River Distillery is there. And I'm looking at a bottle right now that we haven't touched even one bit so far.
That's correct.
Tell me about the Green River in Ohio. Ohio River seems like it's a big river. How would you compare it to, say, some of the ones that we know here and the bigger ones in Florida, like the St. John's or Apalachicola?
No, very different. The Apalachicola starts to get there, mm-hmm. but it's just these big, wide rivers that are industrial-based. We used to see in barges and probably don't want to swim in them. Well, I would say probably don't want to drink straight from them, which, of course, that goes for just a lot of waterways.
Right.
But the Green River was one that we did a lot of water skiing. We even camped. Pretty narrow, but also very deep. Pretty sure it's the same river that, you know, carved out Mammoth Cave.
Wow.
And it makes its connection right there at Ohio. So we spent a lot of time on the Green River. And catfishing, too, was a big thing. And I just remember going out with my grandpa. I never really wanted to go fishing with him on that river because he always had to get so close to the dam that I was like, one motor doesn't start or something goes wrong. Which,
oh,
that was the definition of my grandpa. How I'm still alive is amazing. But
you're hanging out, like, meaning on the outflow side or the you're going into a gate
side? The outflow side where you have all of the, you know, the eddies and the current.
Right.
And yeah, it was a scary proposition, but we caught some big catfish.
Well, yeah, maybe it's worth it then.
And I'm sure everybody listening loves catfish, so.
Well, at least here in this part of Florida, and I grew up doing the same thing, and I enjoy a good catfish, that's for sure.
But I don't need it anymore. I had my share of it.
Right. I guess that's the thing is that you can have something so much it's like, it's not for me anymore, but totally understood. Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation. In addition to fishing, what kind of things did you like to do in school? Were you good at school?
I was a very lazy student. A lot of it came naturally to me. And I was a class clown. I know that will strike a lot of folks as surprising. But I enjoyed school for the most part and made it through and, you know, took the comprehensive classes, the AP classes, as they're called now, and probably could have applied myself a lot more. But I feel like, I don't know if my mom would agree with this, but I feel like my parents provided an environment that said, listen, going to school is important, but getting the other life skills around that are, you got to balance it. You know, you've got to enjoy yourself. You've got to work and then do school. And I was big into band too, which took a lot of time through marching band, jazz band. And I had some bands on the side, rock bands.
Right.
So,
yeah, that's the thing I know about you is that you play the guitar. Let's talk about marching band. Like, what instruments were you playing?
I played trumpet.
Okay.
And was very competitive, which is also a characteristic I have. But yeah, I wanted to be first chair. Me and my best friend are always competing. And to this day, one of the most terrible stories that I have was related to that. When we were at the regional contest in Murfreesboro, and I'd just been competitive to get myself and, you know, play the solo. That's what you want in the trumpet.
Yeah.
And so we were here at our biggest competition, and my mouth just got dry. Totally choked it.
Oh.
Totally choked it. And I just remember, like, I even hate telling that story just for the feeling it gives me. But, you know, I share that with others, you know, like my daughters, and they've had, you know, some letdowns or whatever. I'm just like, you know, let those moments stick with you. Like, maybe it's not always good to compete to try to be at the top, because ultimately you're going to have to perform under pressure.
How old were you when that happened? Do you remember?
I was a senior.
Senior. Oh, boy. So far enough along where it's just the sting. It's like it can't be even formative at that point. You just feel the sting of of what happens.
Yes.
So what is it, the Teddy Roosevelt, it's like, you know, talk softly, you carry a big stick, you know, that kind of thing was, you know, my dad told us, like, you don't say anything, just beat him, you know, that's the goal. Because if I say something, it's like, that's going to happen to me 100% of the time.
Yeah, I think, you know, but looking back now, it was a really good lesson on humility and managing one's ego. Like, it was a blow.
Tell me about the rock bands.
So I had an all Iron Maiden band.
Of course. That's wild.
That wasn't easy. That's difficult music. I mean, it tracks a lot of that sort of heavy metal, tracks a lot of the classical sort of music training. And my friends and my buddies and I at the time were listening to this new band that came out that was just, oh my gosh, they were the devil worshippers, and they're called, I don't know if you've heard of them, called Metallica.
Never heard of them.
No. No. But so we had that band, and then it drifted a little into other, you know, genres, like, you know, Judas Priest or Kiss, and it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that. That's still to this day. That is like one of my favorite things to do, is play in a band.
So no desire, given your first chair status as a trumpet player, did you ever catch the ska fever, where all these kids that for years and years you do marching band, you play the trombone or trumpet or something like that, and then that's it. That's the end of the story, unless you're going to be professional in an orchestra or something like that. But you had this ska phase where everyone's like trumpet players are king.
Yeah, those performers, they hit a whole new level when they can play those high notes and do the trills and all of that. So anytime there's like B.B. King, I remember seeing him live, he had just a fantastic horn section. But they're like, it's like reaching the major leagues. It's only 0.1% or 0.01% of musicians can hit that. It's a tough life. But yeah, anytime I hear that talent, I certainly have an appreciation for it. And yes, I flash back to that Murfreesboro moment.
Yeah. How big was your world back then? And I say that in the sense of like the natural, not just physical, but natural world. So like you said, you're across the river from Evansville. How large was your span of places where you lived? How much time did you spend in the natural world, in terms of, did you go camping, or is living at your house, you know, nearly the same thing? Talk about that a little.
Well, camping was king. And it was at Land Between the Lakes, which is in western Kentucky. And it's a strip of land between the Cumberland and the Tennessee rivers that they dammed in the early 1900s for Kentucky, then later so for Barclay. I think I got that right. And the Tennessee Valley Authority, which I'm sure you know, had a lot of history in the reclamation and damming across in the southeast. But they had this land they managed, and then my grandpa, I guess he discovered it, and we would go there as often as we could, and sometimes for weeks in the summer. It was about 2 hours from Henderson, so it was relatively close, but it would be everybody and the family would be there, and everybody had their spot. This year I took my buddy for his 60th birthday, and we went camping there primitive, and it's like the closest spiritual thing that I've had in a while, just to be in that same space. And I can see, you know, Uncle Dan, he's the one that had the motorhome. I don't know what he did necessarily, but he had money. I think he was good and very frugal. And then the tents where all the kids were, it's just hasn't changed. And it's a lot of time there. I get there whenever I can. It's my happy place for sure. And then back home, I had a motorcycle that I earned the money to buy when I was 13. When I could, I rode around the countryside. And then outside of those two spots, it was Sarasota, Florida. My grandparents had bought a house back in the early 60s. So ever since I can remember, that was kind of the second home, which is what kind of drew me to Florida. I was snowbirded with them. And
yeah, I was getting to that part, which is playing instruments. You're in school. I mean, AP classes and such, like, it's still a pretty good leap for a class clown. And so at what point, you go to school at USF, right?
Yes.
Was it because of your trips to Sarasota that brought you down there? Why'd you choose USF?
Well, we'll start it off at Murray State, where my mom said I was majoring in beerology. She pissed me off so bad. And she's probably right, looking back. And then after a couple of years, I transferred to UK. And then after a year there, I decided I wanted to get serious. It's not that I wasn't, but I was working, going part-time. And I'm like, am I going to do this or not? I like the Tampa area. You know, coming to Sarasota and just a massive Tampa Bay Buccaneer fan, like ridiculous. And so I love that area. I had actually a friend in high school that I saw a couple summers in at Murray State, and he went there, and he told me it was, you know, really nice. So I transferred and finished up at USF my undergrad.
And you also did a master's degree there, right?
I did.
Talk about what you studied, and then talk about why you continued it, you know, past your undergrad period.
So in undergrad, I went to school. I was going to be a doctor, a medical doctor. And after getting my pre-med degree at USF finishing up, and I decided that that was just my ego talking. I really didn't want to be a doctor. I really didn't want to work with, you know, people. I mean, I get grossed out by blood and stuff. So I changed it to zoology. And then it took a few year break, and then decided to get my master's in it. And by this time, I was fully committed. I was in. I wanted to get in. I wanted to do it. And studied population biology, utilizing reptiles, herpetology. So I got my master's in that.
You liked it so much. You must have been good at it as well in terms of the school, because you said you were nominated as having the most outstanding thesis while you were there. Tell me about that. What was that thesis about?
The mark and recapture study for the Florida sand skink, which is a lizard found in Central Florida, nowhere else. And it's fossorial, meaning it swims under the sand. And there'd never been a real population study. People were like, oh, it's endangered. Well, how many are there? What's their density? So I worked with my professor and many other people, and we did the first mark and recapture study on that. A lot of it still stands today in a lot of the protocols they use. And there's some problems with that, but it is what it is. But I was very proud of it. I was really, I never forget you have to understand, I was relentless on begging my major professor to let me into graduate school. He'd already had too many. My GPA was okay. My GREs were pretty good. I finally wore him down. So I'll never forget that day, how proud I was. And he says, hey, we nominated you for that. So it was kind of a big deal.
Wow. You mentioned a gap in there. Was that between undergrad and grad? Was that between Murray State or UK and USF? Where did that fall in there?
Between my undergraduate degree and graduate school.
And the reason I ask that is because you end up at Sarasota County. Had you already started work at that point, or were you doing something else for work?
I got a job at Busch Gardens, and I worked in their conservation departments for a couple of years, and it was a lot of fun. Got to handle and deal with all kinds of interesting animals, and you know, working at Busch Gardens had a lot of great perks too, you know, including 2 free cases of beer a month.
Oh, God bless Anheuser-Busch.
I didn't do a good job saving, just saying, you know, like that.
Oh, right.
Just saying. But that was fun for a while until I was like, all right, I need to advance. I need to do something else. So that's what. But I met my best friend there, my best friends still today from that place.
I mean, it's different than, it's not like you're manning the Scorpion or something. So it's not, you know, it's not like a complete digression.
Don't want me doing that.
Exactly. Were you in a particular spot at Busch Gardens where they just said, hey, you know about animals and therefore we can stick you anywhere at any time? It's a big giant zoo with a brewery and some rides in the middle of it.
More so then, for sure.
Right.
But, well, if you read my resume, I was, you know, supervisor of domestic hoof stop, which meant I swept poop in the goat in the petting zoo. That's where we all had to work a portion of. But we would go out and interact with the public, like do the elephant washes or take snakes out and just do sidewalks and educate people on the animals. It was, like I said, perfect job for where I was in life.
That sounds good. All right, let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. When I say the names Andrew, Ian, Irma, and Michael, what immediately enters your mind? If you answered hurricanes, congratulations, you're a Floridian. We all know that hurricanes bring devastating wind, rain, and storm surge. What you may not already know is that my friends at Sea and Shoreline are the leading innovators in the quest to mitigate the destructive wave energy of storm surges with their patented wave attenuation devices, or WADs. Not only can WADs protect against the effects of storm surge, they can also protect our beaches and shorelines from the massive erosion events that tropical storms and hurricanes bring. In fact, WADs have been shown to increase shoreline accretion. That's right, their technology can help build shorelines. Sea and Shoreline is committed to protecting and preserving Florida's communities and coastlines because they are Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to protect your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, back to the conversation. You graduate, you got a great thesis, you're ready to move on. Were you fishing everywhere for a job, or did you want to go to Sarasota County because you had some sort of connection there?
Well, a buddy of mine that I still in touch with, he said, hey, I think they're looking for a manager of natural resources in Sarasota County, because I knew I wanted something. So I started going and hanging out at this pub where my professor and his buddies were. And Dave Sumter's his name, and give him a shout out, and love Dave. So I put in my application and I went and interviewed. I had no chance. I didn't have any experience, but I guess I made a good enough impression with the director of the time. I interviewed with him that he sent me a note and said, hey, you know, a really long handwritten note, like saying, you're just not ready for this, but I got this other position I think you ought to put in for. And it was an environmental specialist position. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's how I ended up there. It was my, what I call my first real professional job.
And it wasn't your last one there, was it? I mean, you end up going to where you and I met. It's like, you got promoted a few times.
Yep.
Talk about that.
About every 2 years, I get promoted. And I was an environmental specialist. I was out doing wetland vegetation monitoring in August in Sarasota in waders. It was very hot. In a truck with no AC, but did have AM radio at least. That's where I started listening to Jim Rome, and
of course,
still today. I was asked to be the project scientist, and I oversaw some really cool projects like beach renourishment, then Army Corps restoration. That's where I met Mike Soule for the first time.
Really?
He was in Beaches and Shores at the time. So I got a lot of cool, great experience, and learned a great lesson in that job was, you know, responsibility without authority. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went into the resource management. It was a division that did a lot of the land management for Sarasota County and acquiring the environmental lands. They had a couple referendums where they were buying land. So really cut a lot of my teeth in that. And it was unfortunate circumstances how it happened. But when my boss who originally hired me left, I remember one of my great mentors came to me and says, he had me come over to his house. And he said, you have no like experience to do this job, but there's something about you. I want you to step in this director job. And I was like the youngest like director at the time. I was in early 30s, and I was overseeing this department that just a few years earlier I just started.
Right.
So it was a fast track. And that was a really pivotal point, I think, for me. And I was either going to fail miserably or I was going to succeed. So I chose the latter.
Did you spend time when you were at Sarasota? How much interplay did you have with the Water Management District? You mentioned DEP and Mike Soule. How much contact did you have with them prior to you end up leaving to go there?
It was getting more and more towards the end with the Environmental Lands Program referendum. Mm-hmm. We were using our funds to match 50-50 to buy some of those properties. And so I got to know Fritz Musselman at the Water Management District. I'm sure you remember Fritz.
I do indeed.
Then the assistant director job opened up. But that's how I got to know the Water Management District, was really on the non-regulatory side.
Hmm. And is Fritz the one that hired you over to the district then when
yes.
you came over? Yeah.
Yes.
Talk about why did you leave Sarasota? Was it just like, hey, there's a bigger pond to swim in?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. Really, nothing about the Sarasota job was anything I didn't like, but I felt like, okay, I climbed this mountain. I had shared with some folks, like my dream job was to become the secretary of DEP. And it was ego, totally ego driving it. And that's what I set out to do. And I knew the only way I was going to do that was to kind of break out of the local arena, which is a very important arena. I don't mean anything derogatory about that. into more of a regional role.
Right.
And it was buying land for the public. And at the time, there was a lot of money and a lot of opportunity. And Fritz was well known. He's a great teacher in so many ways.
I'm going to say embarrassed. I mean, I can just fine. My dream when I started doing water stuff was someday, if I work hard enough and I get super lucky, I can be Gene Heath. I can be the assistant ED of a water management district. I want to be what he was doing. I didn't know really what he was doing most of the time.
I don't think any of us did. Right?
But I'm like, I like how he's doing it. Funny you say that. So let's talk about the water management district, because I want to get to your opinion on something, or it's a policy question. It's one that comes up a lot. You bought a lot of land while you were at the district. How many acres does the district own right now? Because you're probably at peak when it started to maybe taper off the amount of land that the district could. I'd
say it's 300 something thousand acres.
That sounds about right.
And I was right at the peak. It seems like I'm always chasing the peak, or I'm on the other side of it, and finding myself with the difficult transitions. But yeah, that was somewhere around 300 something thousand. I remember one of the last acquisitions I was part of. There was two. One was the conservation easement on the Carlton Ranch, and then the Longinot. Mm. Was the last two big ones. And we'd done Colt Creek State Park before that, which was the first time I ever went in front of the governor and cabinet. That was really cool.
Yeah, that was a massive one. And Carlton was really huge as well. Mike, those are, and folks out there that don't know them or don't know, that part of the state, it's like those were immense gets for y'all. And so that was pretty cool. Well, let me talk about the back end, though. So, and maybe you and I see the back end is different, which is now you have 300,000 acres of land, and somebody gets to go do the fun stuff, which is I get to go buy this really cool piece of property. And the back end of that is
got to raise the children.
That's right.
So tell Robert Christensen. That's what he say.
Talk about that. So people out there that don't know, it's like there's an immense amount of planning, effort, money that goes into restoring and managing something in a way that someone recognizes as being restored, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a planning process that you have to collaborate. And since you're public, you have to collaborate with so many different stakeholders. No two pieces of land are exactly the same. None of them have the exact same entitlements. It's very fluid, and it's a lot of hard work. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of risk involved. And then when you work for government, the risk factor shuts a lot of things down.
Right.
And so it's a passion of mine. Has been forever, still is to today. Something about being out on that on land, going back to being out in the woods in Kentucky. But there's just a tremendous amount of work, and Florida has so many challenges other places don't have, just because of its subtropical nature and invasive species. And also, not that this is a bad thing, but the public in Florida, everything's very transparent,
right?
And everybody's very vocal, and I don't think that's a bad thing, but it can make it challenging.
It's the competing interest there. It's not the challenge of, hey, we're going to allow, say, camping or hunting even or something on a particular piece of land. It's that when you put hunters on the same piece of land as folks that are horseback riders, and they all want to do it at the exact same time, it's a big community. You've got an area that probably has my guess is 6 million people, maybe somewhere in that territory.
Right.
And of that 6 million people, it doesn't take that many to create that kind of conflict of, this is how I envision what you're going to do with this property. Somebody else has a different idea. And in the middle of that, you've got to sort of meet those obligations, but you have a larger obligation, which is to make sure that you're protecting it for the purpose for which it was bought, which is water resource protection, right?
Right. It's funny you bring up the conflict of equestrians and hunters, because I didn't win that one. I my last meeting, public meeting, they were bringing people in by the busload because we were talking about a certain tract in the Green Swamp of allowing hunting. When I showed up at the district, I couldn't believe these lands weren't allowed to be hunted. I didn't understand that. I grew up, that's what you did. It was an allowable use. It was an important use, and I still believe that, to the chagrin of some of my former workers back there. But it was this kind of this ethics of, you can't hunt these public lands. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
which kind of led me to where I was and I went to an FWC. Right.
Yeah, like that's the thing is like it seems that you enjoy conflicting opinions on things that happen outside more than anyone else, because in order to do that, like that's the Super Bowl of that conflict is where you went next, which is
the
Florida Fish
and Wildlife. Well, it's it's interesting. If I can, I'll tell the story. I went into an area of the Green Swamp, and they were allowing camping and hunting. And the folks that were there were just not being respectful of the land. There was a lot of trash. I don't know if you ever went there. And I went there and I'm thinking, here I am trying to promote hunting. And all it's going to take is one reporter to come out here and we're exposed. And so what I did was I found out who was in charge of hunting and game management at FWC. I called him up, and Nick Wiley. What a dear, like my brother. And I said, Nick, I really think we should have probably more hunting, but here's the problem. It doesn't have a good look right now. He came down and we rode that day together, and I'll never forget, because he was like, oh, you got two sons. What ages are they? And he's like, oh, they're 4 and 2. And he said, what about? I said, yeah, I got two daughters. They're 4 and 2. And he looked at it and he goes, yep, you're right. And I mean, he had realized he'd gotten a friend and a toehold at the Water Management District to help promote that. But that's my first introduction to FWC was Nick Wiley, which is really crazy. Why did I ever end up at FWC if that's your first person? I say that with love, Nick. He knows it. But yeah, that's when I decided it was time to move. I put my application in without talking to Nick, who'd become the executive director. And he called me and he goes, what is this, a joke? I said, no, I want to see if it's a good fit.
So, what was the job that you applied for first?
It's a director of habitat and species conservation. It was a large division. It does all the land management and the species management and invasive control. It was a big group.
Yeah. I mean, I was looking at it and I guess I haven't spent that much time. Like you get to know different people that do different things, but I don't look at it from that large organizational sense often. And I pause to look at, okay, what's in this portfolio at Habitat and Species Conservation? And it's enormous, right? Yeah. Talk about the expanse of that and how much of your role at SwiftMud were you able to carry to that job?
I'd say about 25%, because I remember driving in to the building, which is right next to the Capitol, just stone's throw from here, and just getting that feeling in my stomach, almost like a sick feeling, like, oh my gosh, what am I doing again? Why am I doing this to myself? And it was, but everybody, it couldn't have been better. I mean, it was just tremendous, but it had 5 million acres of responsibility, both, and some of that was with partners and of land management and in the Everglades. So I had all these new ecosystems that I, got to play in, like a new sandbox. And that was my comfort zone, was the land management aspect and dealing with Acquisition and Restoration Council, which I was a member of. That was all great, but
I'm curious, like you talk about ARC, there where you're dealing with other folks, but it's in this very controlled setting. You come from SwiftMud, which you have your big region, very disparate in terms of what you're looking at from sand hills all the way to swamps and beyond. So now you're on this statewide level, and your partners include every water management district in the state. I mean, they're the managing agency on property owned by someone else. And they're all looking at these things from different ways, like you did when you were at SwiftMud, in terms of what should people's access, behavior, et cetera, be on these properties? What should the habitat look like in very different ecosystems? What was your approach? Is it you just hope for the best and dive in? Like, tell me about that.
Well, first of all, at that point in my career, I'd made some connections, like with you. And I knew that if there was ever an issue, I'd reach out to you and vice versa. But my approach was, I knew the Southwest sort of ethos, right? Even though I didn't necessarily understand why it was the way it was, particularly with hunting. But then you go up to the Northwest and it's like, don't take hunting away, right? And then somewhere in between, and then South Florida, that sandbox was one that I really had to study. it really, Florida is several states in one when it comes to, you know, the cultures. And fish and wildlife items seem to, I think, identify and highlight that more than anything. For example, the bear hunt.
Yeah.
In the panhandle, wildly popular. Not so much in Central Florida. maybe not so much in South Florida.
Yeah.
But it's like, where do you draw the lines of a state? Like, would I always ask this question, if Tallahassee was on the border of a state named Western Florida, would the people in Central Florida have cared about those bears? I mean, where do people draw their lines? Because so it was those sort of lessons I had to learn. Like, you got to have some intuition on where that cultural bubble is, and you got to be mindful when you go into it, and you've got to be respectful of the prominent voices. And so that's really kind of how I approached it.
Do you think technology has changed that some, where it used to be, whether you're in Henderson, Kentucky, or where I grew up in Sefner, Florida, it's like you're in this bubble, and it's like, I know what's going on in Valrico and Dover and Plant City, but I don't know, nor do I care what's going on anywhere that's not like where my grandparents live. And so now you've got folks get their news from all different sources all over the place. And we nationalize, globalize the things that we care about, often to people's detriment. Do you get a lot of that? Because I want to talk about managing easily the most contentious, most attended, most active constituents in all of state government, for sure. So probably national government, because you don't invite giant audiences of folks to come out that you know are just waiting in line to tell you what a terrible job you're doing.
Yeah. You know, our friend John Steverson always had a really good statement about that. I won't repeat, but so you mean like technology certainly puts, you know, news at everybody's fingertips. I'm not sure how much people spend time validating some of that. So the social media aspect of it really makes it challenging. And the only way you can fight that fire is with fire. So making sure the agency you have a really good, or best you can in government, social media to sort of compete with that was really important. And we had a great team that spun that up. And we took a little more risk than others would in that, and government would in that arena. But yeah, that definitely made folks more aware. But, you know, you talk about technology changing. And I remember Commissioner Chuck Roberts, he said this, and he was right. And it took a while for it to sink in for me. But, you know, the technology of finding fish has come a long way from then when you used to have to drift around in the Gulf and look to see if you get, you know, the little chart would put
But
everybody, not only do people know with their equipment, but social media, now they know where all the spots are. So the eyes and ears out there in the technology of where fish are has really, I think, outpaced the federal government's ability to do stock assessments, you know, accurately as real time. They're kind of using the old data. But I bring that up as an example of conflict that, unless you stop and study it, you might not put all that together. Face that on the red snapper. That was one of the big issues I had. But yeah, I definitely think that social media, you know, I'm not a big social media guy at all. I'm not a huge fan, to be honest, but not to get into that. But it's a force you must manage.
Is a part of the mitigating against the worst of that essentially two sides of a scale? You have a law enforcement side, and you have, it's just science. You're doing lots and lots of science and working with other partners to do that, making sure that you have it right or at least the best you possibly can when you're going to make those decisions.
Yeah, there's really three parts to that. You have the science, and then you have the, you know, law enforcement, then you have the management, not in the middle necessarily, but takes all of that information and makes the best decision you can moving forward. And it worked pretty well. Mm. It did. It was, I'm not saying we got everything right, but I can assure you, we never made a decision that countered that. Or we might have known our risks. And, I might have pushed people to go out a little bit or others, but it wasn't without having a pretty good, solid understanding. But
How big of a role do your commissioners play? And do they help in finding that ground of how do you make a policy out of things where it's not so black and white? It's like you, in the end, you've got to make some choices.
Well, first of all, working with the commissioners was one of my favorite things. And I don't think a lot of people fit that role. And you know, you worked with the board. Sure. It's a whole different world. But there was a lot of deference that they would give you. In my experience, I just built a really trusting relationship with each of them. And not just as transparent as could be. Because these are highly successful people.
Right.
And so collectively, if you knew how to communicate with each one in a way they understood, they would always give you the tools and the latitude you needed. And if they didn't feel they were straightforward about it. But you've seen the commission meetings. They invite public testimony. Mm-hmm. It's one of the, I mean, it's not without flaws, but it's one of the best governance systems I think I've ever interacted with.
Yeah, almost a Socratic method sometimes of getting through a meeting where it's not just an open dialogue that where you let people come and talk, is like, but it's between each other, between them and staff. It is really remarkable in that way, where you can see something get thought through in real time in terms of how to move forward. It's one of the most remarkable things that I've seen in terms of dealing with a public meeting.
It's a tough job. I always have the commissioners that they got appointed and they went through that first meeting. They're like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. But man, I'll tell you, it was such a dedicated group. Mm-hmm. I love them to death. You know, they were some of the best things ever. I do miss that part.
Let's move philosophically, although you've already done it when you were at SwiftMud, so it's not to say that I don't know that you were already doing this, but somewhere along the line, you went from a zoologist that hosed down elephants to a manager of how many employees at the commission?
And 3,000.
Right. And so you're managing the managers at this point, of agencies. Are you picking up bits and pieces of your management philosophy along the way of how you approach your relationship with the folks that you count on to run organizations?
So the best way I can kind of walk through that is, remember I was telling you when I became the director at Sarasota, mm-hmm. and I had a mentor and it was a big game changer. Mm-hmm. I think I had to realize by almost drowning that my job was no longer to write that report or to edit that report extensively.
Right.
It was to manage people. And I remember just struggling with time management. I didn't have many of these skills. And I just said, I'm going to lean into this. And that's when I decided I'm no longer really a biologist. I'm now a manager.
Right.
And embraced it. Did some self-research and took some courses, and including, you know, Covey sort of things, which was a game changer. And that was my job. It's managing people. And it was from that point moving forward. I didn't embrace it like at first. Mm-hmm. I was resistant.
Is it because you're involved in an agency whose work you love? It's got to be. It's been the thing that you've been interested for so long. It's or the combination of two things that you've based your education, all your work on, and now somebody is telling you, no, you don't get to do it. You get to hire people that are going to do it.
Yeah, I think when I had to learn, but I didn't was reluctant about a manager. I thought it was what you were somebody you told other people what to do. Mm. And then I realized with knowledge-based workers, you know, highly educated, highly trained, it wasn't about that. It was you had to harness them correctly. Mm. And, you know, the disciplinary side of it was never pleasant.
Right.
But it was really a small percentage. But when you have that, I don't know if you've experienced this, but when you have that bad seed or two that you have to deal with, it occupied so much of my mental energy because sometimes it was somebody I really cared for, but I just didn't have any other decision. If I could have taken anything out of human management, that would have been the one. But yeah, I just learned how to communicate and respect people. I mean, I don't know if you know the people I worked with.
Sure.
Gil McRae was the director of the Institute, still is. Hmm. One of the smartest guys I've ever known. But I still had to, I had to lead the agency. And so it was about trust. You know, and that's the thing.
Yeah.
It's really about building that trust with others.
And your set of responsibilities is different now than that. It's like you are answering to a commission who is answering to the governor and also the, you know, the millions of constituents throughout the state of Florida. And so that requires you to make decisions that somebody who is just a zoologist, you know, for a living would make. And that's just, that's life. It's like, but I always found that trying to be upfront with managers about why a decision was being made. Yeah. You don't have to agree with it, but at least you understand this is not something that I woke up this morning and said, hey, we're just going to do it this way that you're going to hate.
Right.
Yeah. It happens, but at least you build that baseline of trust that I'm not arbitrarily making decisions to make their lives miserable.
That's a great point, Brett. That is so important. You know, when you've got so much on your plate, you just want to make a decision and go. And if you see somebody laboring, like just do that and let's move on, which is what you're thinking.
Right.
But the only way to get true buy-in and trust is to say, let me explain to you all to the extent I can.
Right.
I said, some of this is, you know, confidential.
Indeed.
So, yeah, that's really important to explain the why. Because you want to try to mentor and train people on how to think that. And everybody says, they feel like politics is a bad word. It's not. Politics is an actual term.
Right.
It's not a bad word. It is this actual state of being. And there's politics in every single thing, not just in, you know, these agencies. When you're managing multiple personalities, you're managing politics. And when you're at that level and you've got all those things, and, you know, from the governor, from the commissioner, from the constituents to the staff, you've got to try to figure out how to really ride that wave.
Yeah.
And the only way you do so is to try to make each other understand each other.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. And I think that's absolutely true about the politics, because, you know, these folks are sending these representatives, they vote, elect them to go to Tallahassee to make decisions. And they're making decisions partly based on how they think about something, how a constituent feels about it, and then what you and your professional staff do for a living. And it's a special personality that can thread that needle, especially for any period of time.
Yeah.
Like anyone can do. You see county administrators, and I feel so bad for them and city managers, because it doesn't take but a misstep and they just get tossed.
Why would you do it? Yeah. It's like, well, why would you do that? You know, it's why do you put yourself in that situation? But it's true. And you got to know that going in.
Yeah.
Too.
Maybe that's the thing, is like some people don't understand. The stakes are actually high, that it does matter what your agency does from year to year.
Right.
And it's tough to turn a ship once you've done something, you know, whether you're talking about snapper or bears or anything else, right?
It is. It is. The only way you survive is if you have a high level of trust. If people, even if you make a decision they don't like, if they feel like you did it in a thoughtful way, it's the best way. But there's some things that happen that are totally out of your control, that if you haven't built that bank up, you're toast.
Yeah.
And I had to go to that bank a few times, you know, but had enough credibility. But yeah, I'll never forget. I was so honored the day I was appointed. I'll never forget that. It was just the highlight of my career. And I never forget, the next morning I woke up, I was like, next step's out of here. You know, it's like, this is day one and the clock starts now.
Yeah. What do you miss about it?
Well, I missed all the people. I mean, there was no bad seeds in FWC. I loved every single person I met with. I miss going out in the field and listening and seeing and doing that. I miss the commissioners and the relationships that we had. Brett, it got to a point where the highs were not as high and the lows were getting lower. And it was nothing more than 5 years. Mm. And then 5 years as the assistant executive director, almost 60 some odd commission meetings I was responsible for in a large way.
Yeah.
And I just remember, like, that day I was like, this is not fun anymore. I'm like, you know what? My team and others, you can do a good job if that's how you're approaching it, or if that's how you're feeling. And it was the hardest decision I ever made.
Hmm.
And professionally. Oh, gosh.
Did you have, and you come to that point, and I think a lot of people imagine that someone becomes the executive director of Fish and Wildlife and they just do that the rest. They die or something in their chair in their office. But it's not, they're not chairs that belong to their occupants. They belong to commission and a governor and the people of Florida. When it's time to do something different, had you had what you wanted to do next in mind, or was like, if I'm ready to move, then I should do that and leave it to now Roger, obviously, to take up the helm? Or was it you want to go to Garcia Land Management and Environmental Services?
The answer is yes to all of those. But one of the deciding factors, like I was struggling, like I knew it was time for me to go. I had not been paying attention, but there was this lobby ban that I knew I was going to have to work beyond executive director. And this lobby ban essentially restricted me from engaging lobbying for 6 years. Well, if I was 30, that'd been all right.
Right.
But I knew my next step was to get into the private sector and to land management. Well, that pretty much helped kind of push me over the edge. And quite frankly, it was almost like I was grateful for it because it gave me, the right kind of push I needed. And it was terrible to have to tell the staff because it was, a couple months notice, which I would have liked to have worked longer. But, that law, whether you believe it was going to get struck down or court, it didn't matter.
Right.
It was so important to me that I made that. But with Garcia, there's a great story there. When I remember when Governor Scott called me and told me he had this new commissioner, and I was going to love him. And I said, well, I look forward to working on him. And he made an appointment, came into the office, kind of did the 101 with the new commissioner, and it's like 5 minutes late. So I didn't think anything about that. I'm late a lot myself. But and the reason he was late, because he'd already built this relationship with all of the front office people, the administrative assistants, and I remember them coming and opening the door and go, well, Josh is here. Josh is here. You're going to love him. And I'm like, well, first of all, it's Commissioner Kellum. I haven't met him yet. And he's already owned everybody, got him, made best friends. He comes walking in. And we all just fell in love with him instantly. And now it was some time into it. He says, I don't know what your next step is. He goes, but when you're ready to leave, just call me. And so I never even did like the route a lot of the other directors do, where they go work for nonprofits,
right?
And pretty lucrative to do that, but others do like that.
Yeah.
So I called Josh and he said, let's start this company, this new division under the company. And so we did.
You spent up to that point your entire career outside of Busch Gardens, which is a very important part of your career, but you're in government. And so now you're in the private sector, same as me, 20 plus years in government. And then now you're out here amongst the wolves and the inclement weather and all the rest of it. How's the transition been for you?
The transition was very difficult for the first 6 months. To be honest with you, Brent, it was, I had to face my ego once again. I mean, just to be honest, I think most people, if they're honest, when you have a title like that, there's so many things that are in front of you, and so many can't help but start to feel like, oh, yeah, I'm the executive director. I mean, I really tried not to,
right.
But I had to face that. Like, that was really difficult and emotional for me, and I'm just being honest when... And I think most people, if they were honest in those positions, you recognize that. That first 6 months was tough.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, what is this private sector thing? How am I going to fit in? I mean, am I going to succeed?
Yeah.
And so my competitive nature, plus just dealing with a difficult transition, it was a rocky 6 months for me. And I can honestly say I'm glad I made the decision when I did, and I'm really glad I ended up where I did.
Do you think that your competitive nature is what pulls you through that? Because that's what it is, right? In the end, people expect results. They pay you money to do things, and they want something to happen. Your boss wants something to happen. Do you think that's what kind of...
Oh, yeah, 100%.
So tell me about, literally, what do you do for a living right now?
So we manage lands for a multitude of, different types of clients that have different objectives. A lot of it is agricultural based property that's on our rolls that we license. We have some in fee simple, and we're growing. And we want to be one of the largest private land managers in the nation. That's the goal.
Are you just in Florida? Are you beyond Florida already?
We're beyond Florida. We have some properties in North Carolina. We have some properties in Georgia. And we've got several on the horizon that we're expanding into. And just a really diversified. But, you mentioned earlier about ARC and the process and what goes into land management. Well, first of all, is what does the owner or the client want out of it.
Yeah.
And then we design the plans for that. So there's a multitude of, you know, different sort of properties and things that, and how we manage them.
Does it make it easier? I mean, we talk about ARC and you talk about whether it's SwiftMud or Fish and Wildlife and what should happen. There has to be a certain amount of relief of one person looking at it from that perspective, which is the client wants it to look like this. And that makes my job easier.
Yes, it is. And depending on the size of the company that you're working with, some of it, you know, almost approximates going back to managing for the public if you're dealing with a large entity. But if it's single owner, it makes it pretty simple. But there's some people that, you know, buy land and they want it managed, but they don't necessarily know what that entails.
Right.
So you really got to, you know, spend some time first understanding them. Right. And then opening that door, building that trust, and then showing them, look, you know, we can get there together. And oftentimes, you know, just happening, not necessarily bad news, but it may be more complicated in some ways than they think.
Did I hear you say that some of it was a good amount of it was agricultural?
Yeah, there's a lot of agriculture. And we have a fellow vice president I work with. He's over agricultural operations.
So you get into nutrient management as well, things like that, or, you know, water, that kind of thing?
I don't necessarily. A part of my group, we do compliance with the permits that,
okay.
that we have, water use permits and reporting and ERP, environmental resource permits. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to deciding what the ag and then managing the ag, I don't do that. But I have learned a lot. That's been a great part of it all. Mm-hmm. It's just opening a new toy box, you know?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah.
We were talking before we started recording about your drift into RV life. Tell me about where your brain is in that sense.
I think the best way to describe that with Stephanie and I is our hearts are there. Our minds aren't yet. And it was funny because we want to do full-blown, you know, live in RV, maybe have a little place that we can get out of the RV and just feel like a home base. I think we've talked ourselves into the point that if we don't try it, we might regret it. So we're exploring it. And she talked to her friend, Stephanie did, gave some great advice. It said, yeah, she didn't say it like I did, like your heart's there, but your mind isn't. But it's one of these things that'll fall into place. So we're just going to have some fun doing some due diligence. Mm-hmm. We love to travel. I love seeing new places. I love this country, you know, and it's just beautiful and it's so diverse and so much to see and not getting any younger. And I mean, that's really, I get a thrill. It's just like going to new places and it's just awesome. We just went up to Marquette, the Upper Peninsula. I'd never been to the Upper Peninsula. Oh my gosh. It was awesome. And we're like, it's just all validating that we want to do this, but yeah.
Pretty wild, especially it's like, I guess my curiosity then goes to, were you priced out of your own neighborhood's golf course? I know you like to play golf.
Yes.
And you live, 200 feet away from the clubhouse?
Park Barn is my neighbor.
Right. And so is that still, do you still see it as part of your life, just in different parts of the country? Or
Yes. Yes, I do. I love golf. I have to face this fact, it's very difficult to admit, but I have a very ugly swing. I thought it was just my buddy kidding forever. And I went and played with my old college buddy. He goes, my God, that's the ugliest swing. But I'm pretty good.
Yeah.
But yeah, Steph and I love to like play a little golf wherever we travel. We like to fish and play golf wherever we go. So,
nice.
Yeah. She's getting pretty good. She's going to beat me pretty soon.
Oh, yeah. I almost made you bring your guitar today. Because you said something about your songwriting skills not being up to snuff, but that you're good at writing jingles. So what jingles are we talking about here?
You name it. I do have a knack for it, evidently. But I didn't say they were good jingles.
I mean, do you sit in, like, you're sitting with the family watching TV, and you just kind of, like, come up, or you're looking at a bottle of soda and saying...
It's usually something to do with one of the pets that we have. Yeah, there's some really bad ones out there. And then I would do it at work, too, which I gotta shout out, Brett, that I would not have been successful as an executive director without Jennifer Fitzwater and Thomas Eason. Those two, we were like brothers and sisters, but they Jennifer, if you, I don't know if you had her on or,
I did, going to, yeah.
Did she sing any of the, you should have asked her to sing. She probably knows some of those.
Oh, yeah. I should bring her up.
No, but yeah, I enjoy playing guitar and recently just tried my hand in the private sector on guitar, played Duval Street, just me and my guitar case out. Yeah, had a little bet with some of my coworkers. So.
Was it like an open mic or did you talk somebody into like giving you booze or something to play the guitar in there?
No, man, I hit the streets. I went out, I set up on a corner, not necessarily legally, and within a few minutes this restaurant owner came by and heard me and asked me to come play in front of their restaurant. So my group of friends that dropped me off and made the bet, like, they left me to the wolves. And then, you know, 45 minutes later, they come walking out of the establishment they were in. I'm sitting down in the front. They're doing a podcast, and I'm playing songs. And, yeah, I made $260 in an hour.
Well, is that, man, that's the big fallback is. Yeah. And your worst place is to have to
make I'll talk to Stephanie, home. Maybe. She's good with me just pursuing that.
Probably. Probably. I'm going to ask her first before you buy anything down there. Let's get to the kind of standard questions I ask all my guests, because I know I've kept you a long time here, but let's start with what professional accomplishment are you most proud of at this point?
Clearly becoming executive director. That by far was the biggest accomplishment. But within that job, well, there's so many representing the brave law enforcement, so many difficult times and people putting their life on the line, seeing that firsthand. The Python Challenge. Yeah, I know. Yeah. That's one of those double-edged swords, I'm sure a lot of people, but just bringing awareness to the invasives.
Yeah. Is that its purpose? I mean, usually I don't talk when people are doing the last ones, like, but is that the purpose of the Python challenges? I mean, or do you actually get to make a dent? Because I look at them, I look at like the tigerfish and, or is it lionfish?
Lionfish.
And I'm like, are we making a dent? Or is it just like, hey, invasive species are, you know, our thing, please be careful.
Well, I wrote a song about it.
Actually. Of course you did.
Yeah, it was just a situation. There was a group of us sitting around and there was constant, at the time, really social media was not in infancy, but it wasn't as big as it is now. And every Python story would go viral. And I'd get a call from, you know, Governor Scott and his team. And what are we doing? And we really weren't doing much. Mm-hmm. There was a sense, I think, of people for somebody step up and do something. And there was this constant call for a bounty. And bounties just, you know, historically do not work for a lot of reasons.
Right.
So I remember the team, we came up with this concept of the Python Challenge. I just remember presenting it to Nick and he's like, you know, that pause after you do a pitch. And I just remember Nick going, I love it. Just like Nick would do. And we just went all out on that. I mean, the team and it was it. That first one was just crazy, uh-huh. crazy. But I that's something that I don't know. It's notoriety, but
it's incredible. It's an incredibly popular event. I think. I think you know, in the true spirit of Florida Man, I think you know people look at it like, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, but, it does. I mean, when you start seeing a series on a streaming series about it. Carl Hyacin writes about it. You know, there was a team that came up with that concept. All I did was stand in front and say, okay, we're doing this and just give them the confidence behind us. And because it was, I'm telling you, that first one had commissioners show up. There were more cameras there than like Super Bowl day. It was mind blowing.
Wow.
And had investigative reporters that are trying to catch me on CBS. I mean, it was national. It was awesome. I never forget Nick Wiley called me after that, after it was all good and successful. And he goes, I think I know who I want my assistant executive director to be. And I'm like, okay, I don't know. I'm kind of digging this job. But
right.
But yeah, that there were so many things that I love leading teams. I love being part of teams in the true sense. I like to see others get accolades. Mm-hmm. And I like to get them too, you know, just being honest about one's ego. The only way you can really work in a team is if the entire team feels, you know, equal footing and success.
Right. Yeah. Let me go to the other side of that coin. When you look back on your career so far, is there something there, a decision that you made, a program that got started that you would have approached differently? I mean, regardless of whether or not in the end it ends up okay, it's like, would you have done something differently?
No, I don't think so. My mom was always big about everything's for a reason, and when one door closes, one opens. Mm. There were some tragedies I witnessed that, you know, I wish I could have changed. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't think so. I just kind of went with doors open and just stepped through it and go. Yeah.
That's a fair answer. Are you optimistic about the future of the environment and natural systems in Florida?
I believe in optimism. I do. And so, yes, I will be. It's such a challenge, though. And it doesn't matter who's in charge. Managing a system like Florida with so many people is just a really complicated challenge. Mm. But yeah, I'm optimistic because I feel like I've gotten to know enough people in Florida that care that, you know, whether I'm in the arena or not doesn't matter. There's always going to be some champions, and you see them come and you see them maybe burn out and leave. But, you know, it's really important, I think, to mentor people up to do that, to replace you and I. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're already out of that sector, yeah. But, you know, hopefully we mentored and kindled the spirit for people to pass the torch, and they'll have their time and they need to do the same.
Yeah. So is there something that worries you about Florida's prospects as it relates to the environment?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, the sheer population, the sheer mm-hmm. number of people in the state, it's just very difficult to manage the expectations everybody has as a citizen and then to do the things. I mean, you know, regulation's kind of a bad word, and I'm on the other side of that now. Mm-hmm. I'm getting ready to see, I'm learning a lot about that. But, I mean, it's just, that's the role of government is to try to figure out how to manage, you know, sustainability of the environment while providing for the citizens. It's really not one side or the other. That's something that really intrigues me more now than ever, is who's in that middle ground.
Right.
For instance, there's some regulations, particularly I would say in more of the federal side of the Endangered Species Act, that I'm convinced, because the regulations are what they are, probably more detrimental to the species than if someone was trying to work more collaboratively. No doubt in my mind. And I didn't really see that. I mean, I kind of empathized with that in my old job, but until you really see it, until you're on the other side, it's tough. So there's challenges on both, I think, public figures and citizens to get through these challenges.
Hmm. And what advice would you give young people who are just entering or thinking about entering the environmental field, whether it's what you're doing like private sector or public sector?
First is learn how to take management seriously of people. There's a lot of people that understand the biology, and there's really not a whole lot of rocket science when it comes to managing, you know, species and land. I mean, I'm not saying there's not, you have to get that baseline. But I found my experience, so few people treated the management of people as sincere as they treat understanding the scientific systems. Because if you cannot manage people and persuade people, steer them the right way, all that science doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I would say, and this is, I'm too far gone on this, is whatever you got to do, stay on the edge of technology. And even as you get older, force yourself. Particularly in things like, you know, geographic information systems, that world, I've gotten into that in this new company, and I always knew how powerful it was, but it's just getting more and more powerful. Remote sensing and drones, and a lot of the things you needed field biologists for now, you don't need. So better get smart in that, and then of course learning how to manage people and treat everybody really nice on the way up.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is phenomenal advice to end on. Eric Sutton, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been great.
Brett, I really appreciate the opportunity. It's good to see you, man.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. And thank you once again to Rez and CN Shoreline for making it possible. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at ethelwaterpod, and you can reach me directly at ethelwaterpod@gmail.com. Send me your comments and suggestions for who and or what you'd like to know more about. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Sorn for making the best of what he had to work with, and to David Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for the podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free. You should check out the band live, wherever great music is sold. Join me next time for another amazing conversation with someone who has helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State. Until then, keep your whiskey close and your water closer.